Troper, here today, November 14th, 2018, with Mr. Larry Cole. He's the son of one of the Funk Brothers of Motown, Eddie Bongo Brown. Thank you for being here, Mr. Cole.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. To start out with, Larry, where were you born?
I was born in Detroit, Michigan, 1953, in Black Bottoms. That's kind of a historical area of Detroit. A lot of poor Southern people live. August 30th, 1954. 53.
Yeah. Okay. Tell me about your family.
Well, my mother's Florence Mack. She passed away a few years back. Born in 1930 here in Detroit. Lived in Detroit. And there's my mom and stepdad. I have another family that I was raised with. I grew up with them.
Oh, okay.
And that's we had six sisters and two brothers. And my brother passed away. My oldest sister died. My oldest sister was Pat. Then it was me. And then Linda, Cheryl, Chris, Alicia, Gail, Madeline. That's a lot of us. Pretty impressive. I remember it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we all were raised here in Detroit. And then getting back to my mom and dad, now you want to ask me questions while I'm doing this, or you just want me to just keep going?
Oh, you can keep going.
My dad, he was born September 13th, 1932. Make sure I got that right. Yep, 1932. He passed away December 28th, 1984. And but anyway, he's born in Clarksdale, Mississippi, and in 1932, and he lived there. He lived with my grandpa Bud, Edward Brown Sr., and my stepmom. I think her name was Maddie, or I can't remember her name off the top of my head. And he dropped out in I think sixth or seventh grade because he had to help his nieces and stuff. Well, my grandfather was pretty strict.
Okay.
And as soon as he turned 17 or 18, he split and came to Detroit. Mm-hmm. And when he came here, he didn't know his mom really well. Mm-hmm. And he moved in with my grandma Susie. Susie Johnson, or Susie Wright.
So he had family here?
Yeah, his mother lived here. She lived on 14th and Butternut over downtown Detroit. But anyway, he moved in with her, and soon after that, the only kind of jobs he had before was like washing dishes, but he always played, you know, pans and stuff around the house. He was always doing something, banging on stuff, but originally he wanted to be a bass player, and I never knew that till the day.
Wow.
Yeah, he wanted to be a bass player, and then but he was pounding on stuff so much, he ended up playing bongos, and he just got really good at it. But he, when he moved up to Detroit, my grandmother worked in a restaurant off Washington Boulevard, and that's where he met my mother, because my mother worked there. My mother was a waitress there. He was a dishwasher, so you can imagine how that was like. And then from there, it was like some whirlwind infatuation, and then I popped up. Yeah, so, yeah, that's that's how that happened. But they never got married. They were young and wild. They had me, and then which I had contact with my dad off and on, because he was gradually beginning to get into the music business. And I'm not exactly sure when him and Marvin met, but he was. I'm not exactly sure how. I think it was 1962. He was working with at Motown, but he was in a Marvin's band, and he also was Marvin's show for like valet, you know.
Oh, so
and
that's how they met then.
Well, yeah, he was driving around, and but they were really super close, and he was also his signature. He was the chief percussionist at Motown during the golden ages, and so. Let me see. They just clicked big time, huge. You know, everything that Marvin was doing back then, you know, ain't that peculiar. Mm-hmm. You know, all the songs he did. Sure. It's so many, Hitchhike. That's my dad on all the Congress and stuff.
Wow.
And so they just became really, really close. And, you know, that's, I remember Marvin a lot when I would go to the Motown reviews. And I was in his house before I met his wife during the time he was married to Annie Gordy, uh-huh. Barry's sister. Uh-huh. She was a lot older than him. She was very, yeah. very nice to me, very mm-hmm. sweet to me. I remember they had a dog named Peppy. I played with him a lot. And she used to give me Christmas gifts. Real nice lady.
Aww.
And, you know, so when I did the Motown, I went to the Motown reviews, you know, whenever they came to
nice.
Detroit at the Fox. So, you know.
So did you get close with your father later on, or?
Well, not really. We didn't really get super close because okay. he was an entertainer. And that's the side effects that from
yeah.
having a dad that's a celebrity because sure. they're not really around that much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because, you know, he's a musician, mm-hmm. you know, he's creating, he's just all over the place.
Yeah.
But I'm sure he wasn't the only one that had, wasn't there very much.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Did he teach you how to play any instruments? Or?
No, but I taught him a couple things.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. He, it was, I remember, I learned a conga pattern from Santana's first album.
Oh.
And then I remember him coming over. I was playing drums, and he was playing congas. And he came over to the house, and I showed him something. And he couldn't quite get a hold of it. He finally got a hold of it. But it's
yeah.
a real interesting beat, so I taught him something.
Oh,
so,
that's
yeah.
cool.
Yeah, that was
yeah.
cool. Yeah. Never forget that.
So, was it true that your father did not know how to read music?
Oh, yeah. He couldn't read anything. No. He didn't read music. he had an acute ear for timing.
Okay. He's one of those ones that just can hear
it. Yeah. It was just a natural. He was just like a phenom. He just fit right in to a groove and could control the tempo of the groove of the sound. What they were trying to produce, because they were being spontaneous, but they were creating at the same time. They were creating sound. I don't even mm-hmm. know if they were aware of what they were doing. I think they were just doing.
Going with it.
Yeah, they were just doing it, because they, you know, a lot of them were young guys, you know, back in the day, you know, off. Mickey Stevenson found a lot of the musicians. Was it the AR man? Was that it? I think that's the right description of him. He found musicians and stuff like that. So, you know.
Okay.
Nice.
So you were at Marvin Gaye's house while they worked on What's Going On?
Yeah. I was there. I think it was Lynn Barney, Malfar, my dad, Marvin, and Jack. I think Jack Ashford was there. And he answered the door, and he had a Lions shirt on because Marvin wanted to try out for the Lions.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's a whole nother story.
And
so I was in the house, and they were, he had a big, he lived on Outer Drive near mm-hmm. 7 Mile, okay. near Livernois.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Livernois, 7 Mile, in that area. He lived off Outer Drive. There were real big houses on the corner. And a big grand piano in the living room. And I came in, and they were playing around with this. You still good on time?
We're good.
And we smoked a joint. And he was a big pothead. All those guys are huge on weed.
Mm.
And that was about it. That was the last time I saw Marvin live. It was before he left Detroit.
Okay.
I can't remember the year, because he had some mm-hmm. issues going on with the IRS and divorce. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So, what would you say the political climate was like during the time that song was written?
It was really, really ugly.
Yeah.
It was really nasty. There was a lot of assassinations going on, the Vietnam War.
Right.
A lot of people got killed, and it was the age of Aquarius. It was a lot of things changing. It was a little bit after that, because I think What's Going On came out in 71.
Yes.
Something like that. But before that, you know, it was a lot of assassinations.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of political stuff. FBI were doing all kinds of crazy stuff. There was a lot of drugs, a lot of drugs everywhere. Everybody wasn't using drugs, but a lot of people were just dropping out and stuff like that. It was just a really, it was a tragic time, especially in a lot of the black neighborhoods. And it was really rough. Lots of churches, because Marvin was very, very spiritual.
Okay.
And but yeah, the political climate then was very segregated. It was ugly.
Yeah.
A little similar to right now.
Oh,
to be
okay.
Honest, yeah.
That's really sad.
It might be a little worse now.
Yeah.
It's out in the open now.
So did this song, you think, help anything, or?
Yeah, it did. It was something we could all identify with, because if you listen to that whole album, he's telling a story.
Okay.
You know, he's talking about the political climate. He's talking about love. Mm-hmm. He's talking about God. He's talking about coming down off cocaine on flying high in the friendly sky. He's coming down. He's kind of almost describing a cocaine psychosis. So he's really kind of his whole life and everything that was going on in marriage and everything, and his brother, he wrote that song singing about his brother Frankie.
Oh, okay.
And what's going on, he was in Vietnam. Wow. And him and Zelda were here. I think he's got another sister out in California. I think it's his mom and dad was alive. Well, he was alive, so everybody was alive then, you know. So but yeah, that song is very, very personal to a lot of us, because, you know, when you hear what's going on, you go right back to that, you know, what clothes you were wearing, who you were dating, all this kind of stuff. This is really very, very personal for us, is that album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of songs do that. They take you back to a time. Mm-hmm. Any other notable people besides Marvin that you got to meet?
Oh, yeah. God, all the Temptations.
Wow.
When I was a kid, I used to backstage at the Motown Reviews. You know, they had behind the Fox, they have like all these little dressing rooms and elevators and things like that. Doesn't look like nothing like the way it looks now. But I met a lot of the musicians. They used to call me Little Bongo.
Aww.
And I remember, I think it was Florence Ballard brought me a hamburger. Because I was sitting in the hallway for a long time, and I was hungry.
Aww.
And I had a real crush on Mary Wilson, though.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, she was really pretty. And then I met Diana, and all of them. I met Pops Gordy. He was really a good dude. He was a nice old man. He looked like the Colonel. Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Oh, okay,
yeah. I remember him having white hair and a white goatee or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And but I met a lot of people. Stevie. I remember once my dad asked me to hold Marvin's robe and give it to him on the side of the stage when he was done. And I decided to show off and go out in the audience and go to the popcorn stand, and I couldn't get back in when I went back. I got a lot of trouble.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I couldn't get it. I had this robe on myself. I got that. So that was a memorable little experience.
Definitely.
There,
can you tell me what the Motown Reviews were?
Yeah, they were. That was all the Motown acts during the day, back in the day, that they had at the Fox. It was usually around Christmas. They had it all over the United States, but they would have it here in Detroit at the Fox Theater. And they would have, you know, two or three shows, you know, and they would start off with, usually with a comedian like Willie Tyler and Lester. He was a black puppeteer. He had a puppet.
Oh.
And the puppet would, like, really make a lot of raunchy jokes with the people in the front. It was really funny.
Yeah.
He was on Hollywood Squares later on in the future. But anyway, I don't know whatever happened to Willie Tyler. So we would have bands like that, and then Junior Walk and the All-Stars, some of the kind of like groups that were kind of, they were kind of okay, the Four Tops, and then, you know, they had, you know, they had all kinds of acts. They had the Four Tops, the Temptations, and the Supremes, and Marvin. The big acts was the Supremes, Temptations, Marvin. They were always kind of wanted to be better. Marvin wanted to be you know, he wanted to be way up there. He even wanted to be a crooner. I remember him putting an album out, you know, Quiet Nights and Quiet Storm. It didn't go over real well. No, it was kind of, it's like, yeah, I don't know. I think his ego kind of went crazy. But I have it at home. It's nice. I mean, if you want to, you know, like.
Something different.
Yeah, you know, like drool all over the table. But it's kind of, you know, I don't know. Yeah.
Nice. So did you ever end up visiting the recording studio that you're the
Hawk Brothers? Yeah, the Snake Pit? Yeah, sure. Yeah, I was down there. I don't know which album they were recording, because this is really, a lot of people think that'd be really exciting. It's really boring.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you've been in the Motown Museum, haven't you?
I haven't been there yet.
It's really little. The Snake Pit is a doorway that's so small, you have to walk down these stairs, and you're walking right past the engineering section. And I always thought it was bigger than that, but it's in a basement of a house.
Oh,
they built the basement. He had some kind of like, he created a certain sound. There were different cities, they had different sounds. You had Stax Records, you had the Bar K's, and these were all like studio musicians that worked in different places. Then you had the Philly sound, then you had, you know, the Memphis sound, and then you had Motown. And we dominated all of them. Although you had bands from down south like Sam and Dave, and those are the country guys. And they got a good history. That's another story. A lot of the musicians back then were from Muscle Shoals, I believe.
Oh, really?
They were young white musicians, and everybody thought they were black. They were students that played on all those. Yeah, they were really good dudes, man. Yeah. And everybody thought they were brothers. No, they were young, you know, Southern white guys that were really good. Yeah, just like there's a lot of different musicians. But anyway, it was. I remember going up, and Barry lived upstairs above Hitsville. And when we toured the museum with your professor there.
Kim.
With Kim. We went upstairs, and I remember being in there, and I remember sitting at that table. When I was a little boy, I was probably about, I don't know, maybe about 9, 10. Because I think my dad started at Motown around 62, somewhere around in there. But I have a lot of fond memories there. I only went there a few times. You know, I went there with my dad, and he would bring me in the basement. And sometimes they used to have, like, you would see, like, David Ruffin pull up in a pink Cadillac. And, you know, and it was just really, like, just magical to see these people that we would see on Ed Sullivan Show, and I was around them, like touching them and taking pictures of them and stuff and getting autographs. So I had a lot of girlfriends as a kid.
Nice.
So yeah.
So how did Motown's move to Los Angeles affect your family?
Oh, that affected everybody. I thought that was pretty shitty.
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad was the one who told the other Funk Brothers that there was moving vans that then they were recording on. They would record sometimes at Hitsville on the Boulevard, but this Motown was on where the new Joe Louis Arena is.
Oh, yeah.
It was on the corner of Woodward and the freeway. It was a blue building. And I remember my dad was the one who called Jack Ashford and other guys that they moving. And there was a lock on the door, and it was a sign saying that, you know, to go over to Hitsville to record. So they didn't tell anybody.
Wow.
They
so
just
it kinda
jumped
happened
up and
like,
split.
Like overnight, kind of.
Well, yeah. Then they were, Barry Gordy was getting into Hollywood and the Wiz and Lady Sing the Blues. He was getting into other things other than music and the Jackson 5. So the golden age of the Funk Brothers was gradually changing because they found better musicians, and that could evolve with what they were doing. So that may have used a lot of machines and stuff like that, and different musicians. And the Funk Brothers was gradually changing. They were bringing in these, you know, different people coming in and playing and so it was kind of, that sucked the way they moved. I thought, that's a nasty one right there. I thought that was pretty ugly.
Yeah.
But he ended up driving to California, and then he ended up still working with him, did some stuff at Marvin, and then he was gradually, he's doing some other things with like the Silvers, I think, and then Stevie, I think a couple of bands, I can't remember who they were, and he gradually started doing other things with Trini Lopez, Sammy Davis Jr., and Liza Minnelli. He did a lot of stuff with Liza Minnelli. So he was, you know, kind of, they were kind of on their way out, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what it looked like, yeah. That's what it seemed like.
What did you think of the Funk Brothers documentary?
I didn't care for it.
No?
No, it wasn't enough.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it was it was kind of, you know, I thought they should have been a little bit more, it was a little bit more accurate. It was okay. I enjoyed watching it, you know, but,
you know. I think they touched on more people than others, kind of.
Well, they should have. Well, to me, I felt that, you know, there's so many different, like, groups of musicians, you know, and all these new funk brothers, I'm saying, I don't know anything about them. I knew Bob Babbitt played on a lot of stuff with kind of the Temptations when they changed writers. They wanted, you know, they would switch from Bob Babbitt to James Jamison. And, you know, Jack Ashford, he played tambourine and did different things, some percussion. But my dad did the majority of the percussion.
Okay.
On that, you know.
So, do you know what song was your father's favorite, and why?
Oh God, no.
No.
I know some songs music he played on. They gave him a section where he could show his skills.
Oh, okay.
You know, and that was Dennis Coffey's Scorpio. He had a conga solo in that.
Nice.
And I'm not sure. I gotta look this up. But I kind of remember him on Diodato's. I forget the name. It was a 2001 Space Odyssey or something like that. And I think that was my dad on the congas.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure now, so, you know, make sure you put that. I'm not sure on that one.
Oh, yeah. Well,
but he played on, he had a lot of, Marvin gave him room to really show his skills on Hitchhike, Ain't That Peculiar, Stubborn Kind of Fella. My stepmom told me that Marvin had a song that he always thought about my dad. I can't remember which song that was. It was either Ain't That Peculiar or Stubborn Kind of Fella.
Mm-hmm.
One of those songs. I can't remember which one it was. But he had some stuff he played on where he had you could really feel his presence. It was
okay, nice.
Yeah, he was making a statement. Yeah, I really liked that when he did that.
Cool. So what was your father's personality like?
Silly.
Yeah.
Goofy, like me. Goofy, clumsy. Very generous, maybe to a fault.
Mm-hmm.
Really funny sense of humor. He used to act like a monkey. Yeah, that was funny. You know, he would stick his tongue under his upper lip, you know, when he would act like a gorilla. And he was a real hoot. He always kept something going on. He didn't like no dead-ass party.
Yeah.
He would come in and say, is there a damn funeral in this damn place? He was very, very, very funny and lively and honest.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Sounds like a good guy. I know you brought some awards to show me. Would you like to mention which ones those are?
Yeah, well, he was inducted in the Musician Hall of Fame. And it says they're presented to Eddie Bongo Brown in recognition of years of creative genius and contributions to the recording and entertainment industry, the Music Hall of Fame. Is honored to induct you as a member, and that's Eddie Bongo Brown. This is something I'm very, very proud of right here.
Mm-hmm. And what was the date? that that happened? Oh, it looks like November 26, 2007.
Yep, Nashville, Tennessee. So he's there. And this is a picture. This is my favorite picture here. This is my dad when he had a small afro. They used to wear processes.
Okay.
Their hair slicked.
Oh.
And he used to wear a hairstyle that was called three to the side beehive. It was really weird. Him and Eddie Kendricks used to wear the same hair. I think a lot of them had the same barber that was on. There was a pretty famous barber that did a lot of their hair. I think he was on 12th Street. My dad stayed on 12th and Penguin. Mm-hmm. And that was before the riots. And that was a really interesting area.
Yeah.
It was like going to like Mardi Gras or something, you know. Real lively. The record stores was open at like 11 o'clock at night. Mm. People were getting their hair did. There were kids selling Chronicles and Jet magazines. And the restaurants was open. You know, there was a couple girls turning tricks out there. They were high. They were women of the night doing their thing. And there was a lot of hipsters, a lot of, you know, I'm sure there was everything that comes with that, drugs and, you know. Rock and roll, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So that was interesting. But this picture here was when him and Marvin had a little afro. And this was at the Apollo. So my grandma, Susie, she gave me this here. This is my favorite here.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that's nice. You could put this in that.
Yeah,
we'll
take a picture of that.
And then this is one of his. I got this from my stepmom here, Geraldine. This is, I never heard this before. And I just said, well, okay. It's called Making It by David Nodden, is that it?
Nodden,
Yeah, and the tune is called Making It. I mean, it really sucked, too, but anyway, it's okay. I mean, you know, that's okay. I love you, Dad, but it just sucked, man. It's like, you know, I know you were up
that was
of
one
money.
Of your favorites.
Yeah, and this is the Funk Brothers got a square, you know, a Hollywood Walk of Fame in front of Graham's Chinese Steel in that area there.
Oh, nice.
So that was on March 21st, 2013, Hollywood Walk of Fame. So I was really proud of this. It was a pretty big ceremony, too, when they did it. I got up pictures of Stevie and my brother and Jack Ashford, and everybody was there.
Wow.
Yeah, so these are some of the awards. There's quite a few other ones. I have some other photographs of all the songs in the Key of Life. What's Going On, a bunch of other stuff. He got awards and recognition. I think he got some awards here at the, you know, they have at the State Theater, the Detroit Award, some kind of award.
Yeah.
He got some, you know, Lifetime Achievement Award there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there. My stepmom, she was there as well. We went to that. And so he's got a lot of awards I don't even know about. There's so many of them. But these are the ones that I'm familiar with.
So, with all those awards and everything, did he and do you feel like he was recognized adequately for his musical contributions to Motown?
No, not at all. No. It depends on what you mean when you say recognition as well. You know, a lot of those guys were studio musicians. And they only got paid so much money.
Right.
And they would get paid for sessions and different things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure you saw Standing in the Shadows of Motown where some of the musicians used to hide in a funeral home because they were hiding from Barry because they were outsourcing.
Yes.
You know, and they were just trying to make some money. And I remember them wanting my dad to snitch on the other ones. He would never do that. You know, and, you know, what was going on because you could hear some of his. I know his style. That's why I got such a good ear with music because I used to stay up. At night, I missed my dad. I used to listen to him on a transistor radio.
Oh.
And I was able to identify his style. And I was also, that kind of ear kept with other music. And I know musicians' signature when I hear them play.
Yeah.
To this day, I could tell who that is and what's going on. And, you know, if it's
very
a good
cool.
match. And that's from listening to my dad. Obsessively, all day long, all the time. Yeah,
so he was a kind of like your hero or someone you looked up to very much?
Yeah, I did. I looked up to him a lot, missed him a lot. It was, I didn't, you know, I had a lot of questions. I didn't see him a lot, and that kind of bothered me as a younger man and as a young adult as well. But, you know, that's something that you learn how to grow, you grow up on. And you know, you get a little older, you begin to understand that it was, that's a hell of a sacrifice to have like a call, and almost like a minister, where you're so involved in what you're doing that you kind of don't mean to, but you kind of not present.
Yeah.
With your, do you know what I mean? You're not in the present. You're someplace else. You're always
right. You're always thinking about that thing that you.
Yeah, you're never really there, and that's one of the things that happens to people that are either work a lot or, you know, just not there. And that definitely affects a family.
Yeah.
No two ways about it. But, you know, our family's pretty healthy. You know, we get over our stuff. You know.
That's good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you think your father would want his legacy to be, relating to music or otherwise?
Oh, goodness gracious. He just wanted to be appreciated. And recognized for his contributions to American music. You know, I mean, this is just as significant as Beethoven and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Because he changed, he played a role in changing the face of music and how we approach music and a different swag in the music. He would want to be, he would want to be respected as a, one of the pillars at Motown. That's what I, well, it's, that's what I want. But I believe he would want that too.
Yeah.
I just want him to be recognized and acknowledged, because a lot of them wasn't. A lot of them died of drugs, poverty. Every now and then you'll see a few of them at Eastern Market.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Wow.
Playing. You know, a lot of them might be dead now, but I remember running into a few that had some, you know. But that's just, you know, whatever that is, you know, people, you know, everything, some people adjust to that really well when the music is over.
Yeah.
And they have to kind of get a light. That was hard for my dad, because he was just so young as a super famous musician, you know, like all over the world. And then it, the light went out. That right there would be devastating.
Sure.
You know, and I think it took a toll on him. It took a toll. He died. He was 52 when he passed away.
Well, that's young.
And but, you know, that's a, like I said, that's a big sacrifice. When you get into music, you know, it's a, the sacrifice is profound. But the vibe of the... It's spiritual, the music stuff. That's the only way I could describe it. It's more spiritual, because you're on a higher level of communicating. You're communicating not only thought, emotion, and the times in a sound.
Yeah.
You know, where people from another country could understand what they were trying to get across or convey without knowing the language. Do you know what I'm saying? So that's spiritual, to do that. And then the other side is that you can't really market, corner that market, because you can't, you know?
Yeah.
The kid comes and goes, and some people use drugs to influence the musical creativity and da-da-da-da-da-da.
Sure.
You know, but and then there's the downside, because you can't, you know what I mean? So you, there's constant this battle about...
Right. Everyone's always looking for something new.
And then competitive, and then, you know, and then current. You know, that's you know, you got to be a little crazy to do that.
So were the Funk Brothers, they were pretty close then, right?
Oh, yeah, they were all buddies. They were real close. The Funk Brothers, I remember at the Motown we used, the drummer was Benny Benjamin, or it was Uriel Jones. I remember them. I remember Benny, Uriel Jones, James Jamison was on Big. Earl Van Dyke was on Morgan. He was a musical director. My dad was on Congas. It was either Jack Ashford playing tambourine, and there was a couple horn players in there, but the Funk Brothers was Benny Benjamin, my dad, James Jamison, Earl Van Dyke, Eric, can't think of the guitar player that did this. Eric, not Gil. Eric, what's his name? I can't remember his name, but anyway. That's he's the one who did the My Girl. Robert Washington, was that it? I can't remember his name. So.
Any special memories of your father you'd like to share?
Well, there's a whole lot of memories I got, but one that comes up, I remember when I was a kid. I think this was just when he was beginning to work at Motown. My grandmother made me a lemon cake, and he came over to her house. I was probably about 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. And he brought his congas out and played them on the porch, and all the kids in the neighborhood kind of saw what was going on. Yeah, so I remember that's my fondest that's memory, cool. Dad. And Dad and playing congas with him when I was about 17 or 18. Mm-hmm. I was going through my own hippie thing. I was heavily involved in the hippie thing and the Vietnam War. Okay. So I was a product of the 60s.
And mm-hmm. Sure.
I was heavy involved in the Grandy Ballroom, the East Town, so I know Wayne Kramer, a lot of them, MC5, so I was around that crowd. I mean, he had the R&B then, which was okay, but I was more into, Led Zeppelin and The Doors and Jimi Hendrix and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But lost my train of thought. What was the question? I get kind of lost there.
That's okay. So you had your special memory with your dad.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And there was a lot at Motown. I remember when he... I'm not going to mention this. I don't know. So anyway. I remember he... I don't know.
You're not sure about that one?
Yeah, I think of it. Anyway, we were inside of Motown God, I can't say this. I remember him telling me he was going to marry my stepmom. And my response wasn't that good. I was little now. I was young.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So he laughed. She looked at me funny. Because, my mom was just really, my mom was like, my mother was like really fine.
Mm-hmm.
Drop dead fine.
Yeah.
And she, Jerry was a pretty lady, but I just thought, my mother looked prettier. how kids are, say ugly things. But yeah, I remember that memory. And then I remember us playing together. I remember that was fun. I went over to his house when he lived on Stopel on the west side. And I remember us playing, smoked a little weed, and we played. He bought Abraxas Santana album, and he was trying to. That's where I showed him that style of that. It sounded like reminded me of Horses Walking. And I showed him. He couldn't get it, so I had to bump on him. Yeah. I had a lot of memories of him. He was a pretty funny guy.
Mm-hmm.
He it's crazy about my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was crazy about him, too, but it just didn't work. They were young and, toxic.
Sure. Did you live with your mom then?
Yeah, I lived with my mom, and we lived on the east side, and I would see my dad every now and then. I didn't see him a whole lot. Last time I saw him, he was struggling. He wasn't doing that good. It was the last time I saw him, and... I think he died a few years later. I remember when he died, I was washing dishes in the kitchen. There was a window over the sink, and I felt like him walk right through me and out the back window.
Wow.
And my stepdad came over and told me my dad died. I felt him when he died, yeah.
Yeah.
I did, yeah.
So anything else that you would like to add?
My sister, Demita, she really helped me a lot with a lot of this information.
Okay, nice.
You know, she helped really a lot. She's the one who sent me a lot of the photographs. They got the congas and all the records out in L.A. She helped me a lot, Demita. And I've been looking forward to this for a long time. You know? Mm-hmm. And a lot more mature now. I understand the significance of this here.
Yeah.
It used to be more emotional.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Sure.
But it's, you know, more mature now. I just want him to, I don't want anything. Mm-hmm. I just want my dad to be recognized.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it would do his soul good. Mine too.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it would, I think he's getting some rest out of this, you know.
Yeah.
Because I've been excited about this all over the place. You know, and a few people know about it. A couple of my clients, my sisters, they know about it. A few mm-hmm. friends, you know, I was really, because a lot of people know, you know, they know the side effects of growing up mm-hmm. with a famous father by watching me. And what's really cool is that, you know, some of my experience dealing with celebrities, it's enabled me to, I train celebrities so mm-hmm. they don't impress me with their celebrityness.
Right.
That's mm-hmm. why a lot of them hire me. That and my skills.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I get a lot of musicians stage ready. I'm Kim Owens. Kim is a singer here from Detroit. I'm his trainer.
Mm-hmm.
I train, Jackson Smith. That's Patti Smith's son.
Mm.
I trained him. I was one of the first people he told he's going to marry Meg White. He married Meg White.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That was a trip. But anyway, you don't have to get too deep into that one. But yeah, I've trained a lot of people in the music business. Nice mm-hmm. to train Fred Sonic Smith from the MC5. I used to train his manager. Was that Fred? Was his name? He was ended up being Louis Resto's manager. They all from 54 Sound. That's Eminem's. Where they Joel Martin
oh.
used to manage him, and Louis.
Okay.
He got Louis, Jeff Bass, and Marshall Mathers. They got the Academy Award for 8 Mile.
Mm,
got pictures wow. of me with the 8 Mile.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I trained Louis. I'm very close yeah. friends with Louis. But, you know, so I just learned a lot. And a lot of people in the mm-hmm. music business, I've actually kind of like, I would talk to them about being famous,
mm-hmm.
you know. I talked to them about Fool's Paradise.
Oh, yeah?
You know, yeah, well, talk to him about some of the things that being a creative person sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's yeah. only going to last for a period of time. You know, and mm-hmm. You know, I talked a lot when younger about, you know, relationships and
mm-hmm.
being a good person, you know, and stuff yeah. like that. And I told a lot of them to be careful of what they do with some of these fans,
mm-hmm.
you know, before they get catch a video.
Sure.
Online somewhere. So mm-hmm. I've talked to them about that. No, seriously, you get lawsuits.
Oh, yeah,
yes,
sure.
You know, so, because they're, you know, a lot of those guys, a lot of people in the music business are really kind of boring. They're not, a lot of people think you're partying all the day. They just have regular, got kids. They have, you know, sometimes they get sick of all the attention, but they love it at the same time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, and,
And how is it different from being a celebrity back then to today? I know it's
you know, steroids now. It's on steroids now because back then, you know, you would see, you know, one of the four tops riding out Woodward.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, people didn't worship celebrity worshiping that like they do now.
Okay.
Now it's kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, you know, they're just people.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
they're not like, you know, oh my God, oh my God, I'm going to die if I don't touch you. You know, it's yeah. too. Yeah, I remember my sister, Pat, she wouldn't wash her hands because she had a crush on Eddie Kendricks. You know, but I think back then it was totally different now, because when I was into the whole rock and roll scene and during the big ballroom days from 67 to about 71 or so, somewhere around in there in the East Town of the Grandy, we partied with the Rolling Stones and all of them all the time. Joe Cocker, Ron Wood, you know, Jack Bruce from Cream. That was like a normal thing. But it wasn't no really big deal because we saw them all the time, you know. So, but it's different now, being a celebrity now. Plus, they got social media. You know, if you, you know, you fart, you know, they got the picture. You know, describing what you ate. Fart. You know, so, I mean, excuse me being so gross, but it's like ridiculous the way things are now because, you know, like, I don't know Marshall. I never really met him. I never really wanted to meet him. A lot of people were crowding him. But I knew a lot of his musicians, and looking at that kind of fame, you know, he lives in a fortress, you know, and, you know, you sacrifice a lot. Your privacy. You have a lot of people after you for money and friendships. You don't know who your real friend is. You don't know who's videotaping you. You know, so you got kind of, you become like a, like Howard Hughes kind of a little bit. He's not like that, but he's grown up a lot. But, you know, he's, you know, there's side effects that comes with being famous. You know, so looking back, by me living with my mom, I used to miss my dad a lot. I always wanted to be there with him, and, you know, because I had these visions of grandeur and we're going to be doing all this stuff in here. I wouldn't want to live with him. Look, I mean, as an adult. Now, when I was a kid, I wanted to, you know, why can't I be with him? I'm his oldest son, you know. And but now I'm an adult looking back. Oh, no, I wouldn't want to be there. No way. That's way too, priced too high for that and the other stuff that comes with, you know. I wouldn't want that. I mean, looking back now, retrospectively, I would never want that. No, I'd rather stay with my stepdad and my mom. But, you know, but that took a long time to get to that point.
It's a lot different when you're a kid.
Oh, huge different. You know, your emotions is in the front of your chest. You know, so.
So, what is it about Detroit that makes it a hotbed of musical talent, do you think?
You mean now or then?
You can go with both.
That doesn't
want.
Exist now.
No?
No. No, not at all. Back then, music was everywhere. I mean, and everybody played instruments. There was music stores all over the place. Grinnell's was on Woodward. Drum Shop was on Broadway. You had, you know, you could get instruments anywhere all over the place. We had bands all over the place, doo-wop groups during the early 60s. It was just totally different. You can go hear really good live music, not these machines and hip-hop, and which I like hip-hop. I'm okay with that. All right. But, you know, you heard live performances with real organic people, real people on stage playing an instrument. You know, and then the sound, and the, you know, and the singing and the spontaneity, and it's all live now. It's not, they're not rehearsing. This is like right in front of you now. So whatever mistakes they make, you're going to hear it. You know, and there were very little of that because they were just dead on the money. And so now it's kind of, you could make machines in your computer at home by yourself in the living, in the bedroom. And, you know, it's not, you don't have the other musicians. I'm sure they do still, but, you know, the music business sucks right now. It's just, you know, it did then. It still sucks now because they're just ripping people off like crazy. Big. And plus now, the difference now with the music is that back then we had disc jockeys that played whatever they want. But I remember when the record companies, Payola, would start paying the radio station money to play certain songs. So now you don't have radio stations that they can play whatever they want. That died here in Detroit. That pretty much kind of died when we lost WJZZ and then we lost WDET.
Okay.
Even WRAF, they were kind of really good disc jockeys that played. They, you know, they kept a, it was a vibe going on. And when you listen to the radio, especially like people like Rosetta Hine, that's my, that was one of my dad's favorite. She, I don't know if you're familiar with her. She was she was like Miss Detroit. She was on JZZ, and I think it was WJLB or WJLD. I forget which FM station it was. It was a jazz station that went from WJLB or WJLD to WJZZ. And you had people like Ed Love, Rosetta Hines, but they were personal because, you know, she would be playing a song, a jazz tune by, you know, Horace Silvers or whatever, or somebody like that, anybody, you know. And then in a part of the song, she would tell you what the weather was.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah! 80 degrees in Detroit. You know, and then she would come back. It was, like, really personal. You know, we knew when she was pregnant. She had her daughter. So it was totally different. So now, sucks. You hear the same shit all the time on the radio. They're not giving the musicians, they don't give them no kind of air. You don't know what's playing anywhere. I just found out Massive Attack is playing at the Masonic Temple, and I found it out by happenstance. I'm real big in electronica and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I want to go see them. So the music scene now, I really think it sucks. I don't like it at all. There are some really good young musicians coming out, and they're a little bit more savvy with music, and they're producing their own music, and they're keeping all the money.
Okay.
And so I like that with some of those young musicians, but no, the music scene now, I don't like it at all. No, it's you know, a lot of people spent, now like me, for instance, by me growing up in front of live music, like from a little kid. And then the whole hippie thing around live music, you know, all the time, like phenomenal stuff, like, you know, stuff that, you know, I can't even describe to you that I've experienced. So now when I go to a live concert, you know, I'm really disappointed, like really fast. You know, I try not to be, but, you know,
but you've seen all the,
like,
the
amazing doing. Yeah, excuse my language. What is this? This is bullshit. This is like, wait a minute. I'm paying $275 to see this? Are you serious, man? So it's just not as good. You know, there's some good musicians now. Some good groups, like Snarky Puppy is a good group. They're kind of, I don't know if you're familiar with them.
I'm not, no.
Yeah, they're a really good group from, I think they're from Seattle or something like that. Snarky Puppy, really super good group. As far as a musician's group, they all, I think they all went to Berkeley in California. There's a few good groups. I think it's Thievery Connection. That was, that's a pretty good group. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No.
You know,
mostly
these are
country music for me.
Well, yeah, yeah. And then Massive Attack is a really good group. They do their music sounds like soundtracks to a but it's kind of weird. It's kind of, you know, electronica.
Yeah,
but yeah, the music scene now, the radio scene now, it sucks. They don't have, you know, you got these big corporations that just gobbling up all the airways, and they're just puking in our ears. You know, and so that's why a lot of people are looking on YouTube and kind of going back to what they used to like, but it's hard to really get into, you know, what these people are doing now, because it just really, just really sucks. So, no, I don't like the music scene now at all.
You think it'll come back around?
I think everything comes back around at times, but I just think some original stuff need to happen, because okay, during the time of the 60s, that was like the age of Aquarius. We were challenging the government. They were lying to us like left and fucking right. They were killing black folks everywhere. So it was really, really nasty.
Yeah.
They were killing civil rights leaders. They were doing all kinds of different things. But people talked and they communicated. They had much better interpersonal skills. Nobody's texting to say, I love you and all this shit.
Right.
They were, you know, if you want to call somebody, there was no caller ID. You pick the phone up and you answer the phone, or, you know. It was totally different back then. And now it seemed like it's just too much information. It's like way too much information up in the head for people to really just settle down and say hi. Mm-hmm. You know? And so that's, you know, so it's just totally different now, which is fine. But I think people, musicians, need to get to a point they need to express themselves. And that's what I like about some of the hip-hop and some bands like Tribe Called Quest and Jay Dilla from Detroit. I don't know if you're familiar with any of them.
No.
Now, that's somebody you want to interview.
Yeah.
I don't know how to get a hold of them.
Okay.
But they were from Detroit, Slum Village. They did a lot of music for, oh my goodness gracious, Busta Rhymes, Q-Tip from... I mean, you know, he did sampling that you hear it to this day. And he's from Detroit. He died from diabetes. He was pretty sick. But he, you know, hip-hop musicians from all over the place was coming over to him.
Wow.
You know, and they were a couple of brothers, the Yancey brothers. So that's somebody you might want to, you need to document that if you want to document something about something that's current.
Mm-hmm. And what was his name again?
He was Jay Dilla.
Jay Dilla. Okay.
Yeah. They were in some slum, but his mother's still in Detroit, and that would be something, man. That would be a really good interview. I don't know how to get a hold of them. I could try. I'm sure somebody knows Miss Yancey, but yeah, the music scene is just totally different now. You know, I just wish the younger people would be more. A lot of them are going back to older stuff, which is okay, and looking at current things, but. You know, like I said, during the time back then, it was innocent. We wanted change, and it was reflected in the music. There was a lot of creative stuff going on. Then things started getting weird around 92, because the whole hippie thing and the flower power thing was gone. And we were like, a lot of us had kids, and we kind of laid off the drugs and kind of got kind of normal and got real super stiff, and then the younger punks came in, the punk rocker thing.
Yeah,
and then the disco thing came. That was awful.
Yeah, not a fan.
No, that was pretty that was pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
But all these different music scenes, there was a Motown scene during the early 60s, and then you had the Philly sound and you know, the wall of sound from Spencer Davis group. That was somebody else. But, you know, I can't think of that guy's name. He killed his wife, shot her in the face. What was his name? Phil Spector.
Huh?
Yeah. Real creepy dude. Yeah. But he had a really good sound, and he did Tina Turner when she left Ike. They made a song, Mountain High. Was it? I can't think of the name.
Oh, was the Ain't No Mountain?
No, that's Motown. It was... When I was a young girl, I can't remember the name of the song. Anyway, there's different sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would like to see some of the people now create stuff that reflects what's going on now. It's probably going to be kind of strange because this is a really weird time right now.
We're learning
some things now that you're going to hear some angry music. You're going to hear some, you know, some political type stuff. You know, you got all kinds of people going on. Yeah. So it's, you know, so I guess you're gonna some of the music. Hopefully, it'll reflect the truth instead of some watered down. It's the thing, though, about the radio station. Mm-hmm. They're feeding this watered down. Like it's like shit coming out of the speakers. It's horrible music. It's like this is not music, man.
Yeah.
I'll die for you, and I'll just die for you. And I'm going, huh? What the hell are you talking about? So I don't, and then the kids are listening. So anyway, I'm going on a tangent.
That's okay.
You hit a nerve there.
Yeah. So you want something more that has a feeling and is more of a reflection of the time.
Well, something that's intelligent. Well, I mean, it's just not some lazy ass stuff you just came up with in your basement.
Sure.
I'm talking about something. There has to be some intelligence behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which I'm sure a lot of it does, but you know, it doesn't. It's not. It doesn't have no. It doesn't. Doesn't make you feel. You know how some people you meet, something that they said, you remember the feeling more than what they said?
Yeah.
It's not that. That's not there anymore. Right. See, that's the stuff that I noticed from being around music before, where now I feel like a hole in a donut because, or like I'm suffering because I've been around exposed to so much music that now I'm malcontent most of the time. Because I'm going like, this is horrible, man. You're not a musician. What is this shit you're playing, you know? What's going on here, man? This is something I don't know anything about. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Any parting words you'd like to add?
Oh, I've been waiting for this for a long time. Long, long time.
I'm glad we got to do it.
A lot of things over the years. When you have a father like this, he's with you in your head all the time. Mm-hmm. All the time. And not only that, if you're looking at you listen to a commercial and they're playing a movie, there's always his music in the movies. Oh, yeah. And I always hear stuff everywhere it goes. So it's almost like, you know, he's always with me. Mm-hmm. And but I wanted to make sure, I wanted to do something. I'm a spiritual person, mm-hmm. and I'm a godly man, and I wanted to make sure my dad was at rest and the world knows what he contributed to the American music. That's mm-hmm. what I wanted. And I'm very, very pleased. I'm so glad that I came here to talk with you.
Perfect. I was so yeah. glad to talk to you.
Yeah.
Well, that was Sarah Troper interviewing Mr. Larry Cole about his father, Eddie Bongo Brown. Thank you so much, Mr. Cole.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Cool.
You get it all?